bloody awesome! Hey everybody, welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. I'm John Burke, and with me from across the pond is Matt Hudson from whatiwatchtonight.co.uk. Matt, how you doing, sir?
I am doing very well, JB. We are almost in spooky season. We are now in pumpkin spice season. We are in the most basic of seasons, and I am absolutely here for it. I had my first pumpkin spice latte this week of the year, so I'm very excited about that. It's still really hot, but whatever. It is what it is. But we're getting into scary season. Here on the BAMP, though, as we mentioned, we're kind of in the midst of scary season because starting from a few weeks ago and ending in mid-October, we have a potentially torrential run of films to cover, but we'll get to that. I'm good though, my friend. How are you? Keeping Florida safe and well?
Doing pretty well. It's also very hot here. Local Aldi, I think that I'm just gonna say their name, they have like so much pumpkin flavored product right now, dude. I got like pumpkin loaf cake the other day, which was really tasty. And then they have, dude, I don't know if I've told you, I'm into like sparkling water now. That's like my go-to beverage. They have a pumpkin pie flavored sparkling water.
It's so American.
Dude, it's so good. It's zero calories. It tastes like pumpkin pie.
It doesn't
go with everything because of that. You know, like it's more of like a casual drink it by itself type of drink. But man, I like all these sparkling water anyways. Like it's for the price and the flavor, it's pretty good. And the pumpkin pie is their seasonal, and I'm like, oh man, I'm going to be sad when this is gone. But yeah, they have a whole end cap of like pumpkin spice flavored products. Damn. And I have not indulged in all of them, but man, is it tempting, because there's like pumpkin spice oatmeal and pumpkin spice flavored Oreos.
It's,
and
I'm like, early days so far. Sorry to drink. I've just said it's hot. As you were talking, the heavens have opened here and it's hammering it down now. So there's welcome to England. We've just got a new Aldi open up around the corner from where I am. Literally, it's opened up about a day or two ago. So I will be going there tomorrow night if I don't go to the gym, which I probably should go to the gym. I can do both. And I'm going to see if they have that pumpkin pie sparkling water, or if my claim that it is so American holds any weight.
I like sparkling water has become really trendy here over because it's zero calorie, but it still gives you the carbonation flavor. Most of them don't have too much stuff in them. Like they're like zero, almost. It's basically, supposedly, it's just like drinking water, except it tastes like something else. And so I've been really drinking that a lot and I like it. But yeah, if they have it, man, test it out because it's pretty wildly delicious.
I will. I'm not a big sparkling water fan, so this could be what changes my mind on the whole carbonated H2O.
I used to not like it either, and then I kind of just dislike. I'm like, I'm going to get where I enjoy this, and I have. So, like many things, if you train yourself to enjoy something, or it might be untraining yourself to, you know, from sugary beverages to the unsugary kind, where like, you know, that flavors there, it's just maybe not enough compared to the other stuff you've been eating or drinking. So, but yeah. I don't know for sure what happened, but I've totally 180'd on it. Like probably a year ago, I was giving people crap for buying like bubbly or LaCroix, and now I'm like, yeah, give me one of those. So
the Bloody Awesome Sparkling Water Podcast is here.
We are here for it, but really we got to take you to church, Matt.
Yeah.
We got to go to church this week, folks. If you don't know, we're here to review the newest one, Conjureverse. I don't know what it's supposed to be called. I don't like the Conjureverse, guys. If you've been listening to this show, it's become apparent that I apparently don't like James Wan, not as a person, but as a filmmaker. And I like three of his movies. I like The Conjuring.
Yeah,
I like the one with the puppet that I don't remember what it's called. Silence. Dead Silence. Is that it?
Yes, sir.
And then, I always forget the third one. What's the other one I like?
Not Malignant, but I like that.
No, I didn't like Malignant.
I don't like Aquaman either.
I'm not a big fan of Aquaman. I could have sworn there were three.
One of the Fast films?
Did he do a Fast film? Then yeah, that's probably sure. It. But, you know, I don't know. Like, I don't find a lot of his later stuff. I don't like Conjuring 2. I and obviously he didn't direct The Nun, but he's responsible for these movies that keep getting shoved into this universe with the Warrens, and I don't like them pretty much collectively so far. But let's find out how I feel about The Nun 2, because yes, they did a sequel to that beloved film from 2018. Was that when Nun came out? I don't even remember.
Believe it or not, it was, yeah.
So let's get to the stats, folks. This time it's directed by Michael Chavez, I'm assuming. I hope it's not something else. He did something else that I think I like.
He's done The Curse of La Llorona, which is another Conjuring first film. He also did The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. Also directed Billie Eilish, Bury Your Friends music video. So he's only done three
music videos.
I think.
But I don't like any of his movies that I've seen, now that you say it. And I started to watch The Curse of La Llorona on a plane, and luckily we landed, so I could stop. Tysa Farmiga is, I'm sorry, it's written by Ian Goldberg, Richard Nying, and Akila Cooper, and I definitely butchered that last name, I'm so sorry. Not Cooper, the other one. And stars Tysa Farmiga, which of course we clearly know there has to be a reason they would cast the sister of Vera Farmiga in a movie where her character set up the entire universe, but apparently still not clear if there's any actual reason for that casting outside of coincidence. But she plays Irene, not the titular nun, to be fair, but maybe, I don't know. Jonas Bloquet. Aha. He plays a character named Maurice, but in the first movie, we don't know his name till the end. They drag poor Storm Reid into this. She's in here. Anna Popplewell. That IMDb just moved way too many spots. Well, then we got the actress who plays the nun. Bonnie Ahrens, who I think is like suing for not getting paid enough.
Sounds like Studios 101. I saw this story the other day. I'm not clued up enough on it to really go into it, but I'm trying to do with her likeness, or she's not being paid for something with her in these films. But she is these films. She is the face of the films.
Yeah. And many of the Conjuring, like what she shows up in, like two, right?
That's where she makes her debut.
Yeah, Caitlin Rose Downey is Sophie, and then I think we can. There's a lot of other kid actors, but yeah, that's probably sufficient. Most of them don't get a lot of screen time, or they're just bullies for 30 seconds. It's a whole bunch of stuff. So that's the gist of the stats. The synopsis of the film, in case you didn't know, it's set in 1956 France, because they all speak French. They don't, none of them, except the one guy's name is Maurice. A priest is murdered. Yep, and evil is spreading. All right. Ooh. The sequel to the worldwide smash hit follows Sister Irene as she once again comes face to face with Valak, the demon nun. Ratings. So critics generally not enjoying this. 46% Rotten Tomato. Audience, I need you to calm down. Sit with a 75%. Be real. No. It's not 75% of you that can like this movie. I do not fathom how that is possible. 48 on Metascore. So again, critics not liking this. 6.1 IMDb user score. I'm a little more accepting of. I can deal with a 6 from a casual fan base. 2.5 Letterbox. It's currently in theaters everywhere worldwide, I think, wherever it's going to probably end up. This was a major big release, and it did, I think, pretty well at the box office this past weekend, especially for a September release.
First film, I mean, we laugh at calling it a smash hit. The first film's budget, JB, was $22 million. It raked in $365 million worldwide, which by definition was a box office smash hit, but it rhymed with smash hit how it ended up, but it wasn't my favorite film of that year.
Not even close for me, dude. I really wanted to leave the theater watching The Nun. I found it very boring at times, but also so convoluted with its lore, and it gets worse in The Nun 2 as far as the lore. Like, there is way too much going on with the lore or what's supposed to happen, and I get that in all horror movies, there are some contrivances that things don't always make sense. Like why in the movie Poltergeist, why does the poltergeist decide to stack all the chairs? It's scary, but it doesn't really make sense. What is the end game for the poltergeist? Do they just not like furniture? Like, what's the point? You know, we have that in tons of horror movies. When it's noticeable while you're watching it is when I feel like it's a problem. If you are oblivious to those contrivances because it feels like part of the film, like you're there and you don't really think about it till afterwards, then I think it's okay. But when it's blatantly, you're like, why is the nun in the shape of a magazine rack right now? I don't understand what the nun's goal is. And I honestly, there's a MacGuffin in this movie that I still don't understand having seen the movie. I'm like, why were they after that? It didn't seem make any sense. And obviously this is spoiler free, folks, so I won't get into the MacGuffin or how the story plays out or who's affected by it and anything like that. But I didn't enjoy this movie, yet I didn't hate it. I will say, pulling back a little bit on my vitriol, I don't think a lot of it works. I think there's a lot of things. I think there's too much going on. There's a lot of new characters introduced, but also a lot of old characters. And for a movie from 5 years ago that I didn't like in the first place, not easy to remember all the details, folks. So if you haven't seen it since 2018, you might want to read a refresher because you will be lost. Because I was like, wait, am I supposed to know who this guy is? There's the opening shot for Maurice is a tracking shot, a very familiar looking shot, right? Where we're behind him, he's holding a watering can, and then it finally pans and we see him. And I think now, having seen the film, we're supposed to be like, oh, there he is. But I wasn't like that, because I'm like, who's that guy? I was waiting for a character introduction. I was supposed to know him already. Literally had never seen him before. That's how it felt. Clearly I had. I saw the first movie, but looking at this guy, complete face blindness to this. I'm like, I don't know who that guy is. I've never seen him before in my life. And even my letterbox is like, oh no, sir, you've seen him in like five other movies. I'm like, nope, that's not possible. Never seen this guy before. But there he is. And you know, I'm not a big fan of the whole Conjureverse thing. I wish it wasn't all interconnected. It doesn't feel like it's going to pay off in any way that's going to be meaningful. I can't see where they're going with it. That's the thing. Like that was, you know, Marvel ruined film storytelling in a way by doing the connective universe.
Okay, Scorsese, you back up.
Well, only because there's this need that these other companies are trying to mimic it, and they all seem to be missing what was essential to the first 22 movies of the cinematic universe for MCU, was that from the get-go-ish, they did have I'm going to use the phrase endgame in mind for the franchise. Like, I'm sure it wasn't from Iron Man, but like within the first five movies, they were already starting to like build their endpoint. Like they knew they wanted to get to this big battle with Thanos, and whether or not it was going to play out the way it was going to, they always had that in mind. And this new phase, they implied that they had it. I really am starting to question if they ever really had it, because it doesn't feel as connective as the first one, or maybe it's just the fact that it's just more of the same. But I don't know that a lot of these other franchises have an end game in mind. It's like they're kind of winging it. Like we're going to make movies, they're all connected, but why are they connected? Was there really a benefit for this connection other than cramming it in? Because it really doesn't feel like there's a benefit to it. Like, because even if you want to go back to Annabelle, they tease Annabelle in the first Conjuring film. We see her in the museum. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes sense that we would get a movie, but it doesn't have to be connected. We could just get Annabelle's story, right? Like, we know Annabelle's in the museum. Why did it end up in the museum? Don't worry about the Warren connection outside of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, use that as a entry point. Like, spinoffs on TV, right? Like, a show has a character on it. The character mm-hmm. moves away, and then we get a show with them. And most of the time, they're terrible. Every once in a while, it's worked. The Jeffersons, great example, right? Like, they were on the Archie Bunker show that I don't remember what that's called. All in the Family, something like that. The Jeffersons were popping, so they're like, hey, let's give them a show. Boom, better show, I think. You know, like, that's the stuff. So I'd be down for that, but this connective stuff, because this movie doesn't feel like it's self-contained enough, but also that it's going to pay off, that there is this connection that they keep teasing in the film. Mm-hmm. I don't understand. It feels real trite and really silly at times. And they introduce some ideas that really feel counter to the overall Conjuring verse, by the way, that I can't talk about until we get to spoilers, but where I'm like, well, this idea introduces a whole bunch of stuff that won't make sense in what we've seen from the supposedly true stories of the Conjuring and Conjuring 2 and 3, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, see, that's a bad decision then. If you're introducing ideas that feel inherently fictional with real stuff, because it's like, well, what are you going for? What's the point? Because I think it changes the tone of the film in a way that doesn't mesh, or at least as a universe. Again, if this were a standalone film, do what you want to do, you know, blend it. But if you're trying to blend two kind of what feel like contradictory ideas, I don't think it's going to work. I'm looking, there's some gnarly scenes in this film, but nothing that I thought was like incredible or like, oh, there is a section towards the end. Again, I got to wait till spoilers to talk about a lot of the stuff that really bugged me, but I'm just like, what is this? What is happening? Why are they doing this? And yeah, I literally in my notes, I have the word dumb with a period. I don't have anything telling me specifically what I'm going with like what I'm calling dumb. I just wrote the word dumb. I felt the need to remind myself to when we were talking later to say dumb. So folks, if you're wondering how I feel about The Nun 2, let's just summarize it with dumb. Matt, dumb. What did you think about The Nun 2?
Right. So The Nun 2, I'm with you on the whole interconnectivity of it all. It does not need to be. You don't need scenes to kind of wink and point you in the direction of the next film that's coming out or the ones that have been before, other than maybe a passing reference to somebody's name or something that happened which one of the characters actually has a connection to. But I don't think you need to have such tight interconnectivity. But here we are, like you say, Marvel has ruined cinema in that sense that we get everything's connected. We need to have post-credit scenes to explain what's going on or to advertise the next film. But yeah, The Nun, the first one, I didn't like it. I mean, I'm glad that your enjoyment level was none, because mine was almost none too. I had to get the pun in somewhere. So this one, The Nun 2, for the similarly to Fast X, I think, and that's where the comparisons to these two films end, really. They're both bad. But for the first half an hour, I was like, I was in danger of thinking, I quite enjoy this. There's nothing wrong with this. In fact, I like it. I thought the intro, I actually like the introductory scene. I like the fact that it just opened with a, no spoiler, but opens with a bang. I was like, okay, I dig it. It's sticking its flag in the sand and saying, initially, I thought this is the tone we're going for. Okay, fine. And then not long after, one of the taboos of horror is broken involving kids. So, like, oh, right. Okay. Michael Chavez is taking us down this path. Maybe we're going to get some real actual vengeance here. But then, to use a John Burkeism, the film doesn't follow its own logic. And this is a supernatural film or horror film issue where you have a villain who could wipe out everybody with a wink. And sometimes they do. But sometimes they decide not to, and it usually involves our main characters. And that really does annoy me. But they're in times where you're like, oh, this is it for the main. There's no way they can get out of this. And the next scene, they're just found lying on the street. Like, what? But you killed some paper boy for less. That is something that really grinds my gears. And this film is very, very guilty of that. And it's a shame, because I think the nun, Valak, is a cool character. I think the concept is cool. I've seen some commentators this week saying it's an iconic horror character. I don't know if it is. Maybe it is, now that she's been in 2.5 films. Maybe she can. If we can call Art the Clown one, then maybe why can't we call the Nun? I think, like, as a character, as an image, I think she's very iconic for contemporary horror.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that the films she's been in haven't been particularly very good, which I don't think is the Nun's fault. It's because when she's on screen, I like the presence that she brings. I like the darkness that she kind of that she delivers. But the character is underutilized, and not in a Jaws way where we're holding the character back for the big. It's just they'll have a tease and a wink and a nod there, but then it's undercut by something stupid like a statue falling down, which just it, yeah. There's a few moments in this, JB, because I had the theater to myself, and a whole theater. We had a big screen, screen six where I was, hundreds of seats, and it was just me. So I could, and I don't talk, but I could exclaim. And there was a few times, of course, we keep this family friendly, where I literally said, "Oh, off." Towards the end, I'm like, just don't. It, there was there's a moment with the MacGuffin where somebody touches it and it just lights up. I was like, oh, just don't. This is this is it. And it's a shame, because a bit like The Pope's Exorcist, which I will compare this to, I think I prefer that film. I prefer that film, but it starts off quite well when it's more of like an investigative type film, or where we're setting the scenes and the scene for what's going on. That worked, and then with The Pope's Exorcist, similar to this, it just goes too wild at the end, too stupid, and it falls apart. But again, I don't expect much from a film like this, and I don't mean to be negative, but I don't expect stunning dialogue. I know previously I've said I would like a script to be coherent, but there are genres or subgenres where you know what to expect, but I do expect to get some characters to give a damn about, which is a shame, because it's not a Taser Fimiga or a Storm Reid issue, but I think they're both awful in this. And I've seen other commentators say they actually think they were really good and they provided a spark. I think they were both both at least average at best in this film. And a lot of that is because a lot of stuff they had to spew. But for example, one Storm Reid's character, who goes by the name of Deborah, Sister Deborah, at one point she says to Irene, "You need me." And then, that never really ever pays off, to the point of she probably didn't need you in this to go and do whatever they were needing to do. Obviously, we'll get into that in spoilers. But so I thought the two main characters, they were vanilla. Whereas I mentioned Russell Crowe in The Pope's Exorcist. He may not have been the best character ever, but he felt like one. And I got his motivations. He felt a bit more one note. Sister Irene is so bland. It hurts almost in this film. And that took a lot away from the film for me, because even if the character had just a bit more flamboyance to them, or a bit more just something to cling on to, I would have got a lot more out of this film. But alas, I did like the production design. I think the film looks good. I think the locations look good. And you mentioned the magazine set piece. I understand the motivation is, why the hell would the demon do that?
Yeah.
However, I did actually like that idea, like the whole. I didn't see the trailer. I'll preface this now. I didn't see the trailer before this. I subsequently went to watch it afterwards, and most of it is in the trailer. But so had I seen the magazine stand sequence in the trailer, it wouldn't have hit well in the film. However, I liked it. Did it go on for a bit too long, like the film? Maybe it went on for a beat or so too long. But I liked the idea of it, even if when you step back and look at it, didn't really make much sense for the demon to do what they did. And then the aftermath of that plays into what I was saying about they just don't follow their own rules, and it becomes laughable at times. Enjoyed the first half an hour, not going to lie, thought that was pretty good. And then when we got to the location and we started fleshing out what was happening, we started to see more from returning characters, of which I had no idea who they were, thanks to JB for warning me in advance about that. And the film tried to tell me who it was, but once we got into that, I was like, the film started to lose me. Look, there are some cool moments still in between these bits, and it does involve our nun friend. There's one bit which is pretty evil, which involved the kind of the matriarch of the monastery, the boarding school that they're set in.
Oh, yeah.
When she goes into this chapel. I was like, you know, that's a nasty thing to do. But the film needed that, and I do believe that Michael Chavez, after the test screenings, was the audience told him it's not scary, nothing happened. So he went in and upped those scares, up the gore a bit more. And whilst the film isn't scary, I think it's more atmospheric than the first film. I think this film is better than the first film, whether that's a bar to hit or not, I don't know. And the kid actor in it, and I think she's in her teen, Caitlin Rose Downey, she's fine. And I'll tell you something, Jay, she's got a proper horror scream. Like Samara Weaving has, she's got a real scream for horror films, and she's
good. Reminds me of the girl in Ouija, the second
Ouija 2, Born of Evil, or whatever it's called.
Which is the better of the two, from my understanding. I actually never saw it. Yeah, it is the Flanagan one.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I think she's good in it, and we don't want to dump on young actors or kid actors, but sometimes they aren't always the best, as can be labeled adults. But I think she's good in this.
I think the biggest problem with this movie is that I feel like they cram Irene and Deborah into the story. I think if you make Popplewell, maybe she has some background, or she's the one who fights the nun because it's after her daughter. Like these other two nuns that show up feel like, it feels like franchise filmmaking. Like they need to cram these other characters in.
Yes, yeah. And it
convolutes the story to a point where it's like, well, we don't need that though. You could just have this very basic story. You have Maurice there. There's your history. Mm. That's your tie into the first movie, but don't make him the main character. You know, make the new character and the young girl, Sophie, as you put everything on her. Cause she can, I think she carries it. She's much more compelling than
Irene,
Vanilla Farmiga.
You're right. Sorry, I was laughing because I was just thinking about parts of the film. I mean, I will not spoil it, but the MacGuffin again, how they get to know where the location of this thing is and where it ends up being. I'm like, just leave this whole thing alone. And also, you mentioned connectivity with the Farmigas. There is a very, very, very big bit of connectivity. It's blinking, you'll miss it, but there's a huge bit of connectivity, which explains why both Farmigas are in these films, which is tied to that MacGuffin. But I was just laughing to myself because what you're saying is dead on. It genuinely is. I know we tend to agree with each other, but because the sisters, again, I'm dodging spoilers, but our sisters, Irene and Deborah, they have to find this MacGuffin, and they have to go around and find this MacGuffin. And they end up where they end up. And I'm thinking, well, if we just follow the Burke route of just following Popplewell and Sophie, we could have cut out that entire search for that MacGuffin, because it ended up being convoluted, eye-rolling, predictable, and lazy as well. And that is the worst thing I can attribute to any film, when it is lazy. And this is what a lot of the convolution of the storylines is. It's just lazy beats, lazy subplots, which you can get rid of. And I do think, I will say it, get rid of Irene and Deborah for the most part. I think the nun too, actually, with some of the atmospheric scenes it's got, with some of the scares, with some of the kills, could actually have been a pretty decent film. A bit like Annabelle Creation broke the mold a little bit with those films. This could have been that.
All the scenes you could have had that you are forcing us to like sit on the train with Irene and Deborah, or like go to their investigation. Like those scenes could have been dedicated to developing these new characters and developing the horror of the demon nun. And instead it's wasted on this superfluous story that ultimately, yes, it all ties in together, but not in a way that's satisfying, in a way that's predictable and kind of boring. And that's where the movie really loses it.
Yeah. That's the problem. The film is trying, like I said, it's full of cliche. It's full of convention. Guess what, guys? Sound the bell, because it's coming. It's too long, because it is. But there is, I do think there is a really good, well, okay. I do think there is a very solid film in here. And for that first half an hour, I will happily admit, because this is what we do on the band, we're honest, I was enjoying. I was like, this is pretty good. This is a step up. I like where we're going. We've seen some pretty gnarly stuff. I like the direction, but it's when they start introducing too many characters, too many subplots, too many reasons for us to try and care, plus the overall MacGuffin, which is bloody awful, then it just falls apart under its own. It cannot maintain its own weight over the course of an hour and 50 minutes. And, you know, there's only one film in history, you know, John rolled his eyes, that has ever said the word demon, and it just doesn't sound silly. And that is, of course, the greatest exorcism film ever. You got Father Marion saying the word demon, smacks Von Sydow and imbues it with so much weight. Karras too, and even when Chris McNeil flippantly says, oh, you know, what happens if she was possessed by a demon? In this film, they mention the word demon and try to make it sound so serious. You have a father talking to the nuns about the demon, you know, when it were the demon's powers. And I'm thinking, guys, stop mentioning the demon. There's a moment when one of the characters' mothers, after about 15 minutes of absolute carnage happens, she's like, Where's my kid? It's like, you should have thought about that immediately. And then they keep saying things related to the MacGuffin, which I was like, who wrote this and thought anybody could pull this off? It's Star Wars prequels all over again. You could get the best actors in the world, which they didn't, maybe, but to say the dialogue, and nobody's selling this. Same here. You could get anybody in these roles and they cannot sell this dialogue. Problem is, they're trying to sell it. They're trying to make this, you know, serious, weighty horror. And you can't because of what they're saying and how they're saying it and how they're directed to do so. Good intro. Fell apart about halfway through for me. Still had some good scenes in that final half, but it's too long. Like you said, John, I totally agree. Too many unnecessary subplots. They focused on the wrong characters in their lust to connect things together. It is better than I thought it was going to be based on my experiences with The Nun. But I mean, how much more can you take out of this? I mean, I believe The Conjuring, The Last Rites is the last film where the Warrens, Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson will appear. I believe. In which case, fine. But if this film makes bank, because it's already sitting at nearly $100 million worldwide off a $32 million budget, a Warner Brothers going to think, yeah, let's call it a day. Will we get a Nun 3? Will we get more of these, John? Can you see that being a real possibility?
I mean, I feel like, yes, it's a real possibility, especially because it's making money.
Yeah,
it's making money, and obviously the fans seem to enjoy it. The thing that irritates me about the 70% on RT audience is, like, there are such better horror movies, guys. Like, it's not like, I know there are some critics who just pan the whole genre or write the genre off, and it's not that with me. And I think that you go through, like, this year, there's been some tremendously great horror films. That's what upsets me is like, it's okay to like, this isn't the worst movie. Like, I'm not sitting here going, this is the worst film, I can't believe people enjoy it. It's just like, but it's so vanilla. It's so bland. It's so basic. And it misses on a lot of the swings that it does take. It strikes to me. Like, it's just whiffs, I guess is a better word. Yeah. And that's what's upsetting to me more, is because, like, you see, like you said, the opening, if I didn't know what movie I was sitting in and I saw that opening, I'd be like, ooh, what's going on? But I'm watching that opening going, why are we doing this, though? Why? Because that's not what this is going to be. These aren't, like, I know Irene is in this freaking movie. You know, like, I didn't know a lot about the movie, though, from the trailers, to be fair. Like, I honestly, when Storm Reed showed up, I'm like, oh, really? We're getting a new character? And it's like, it's Storm Reed. All right, cool. But then, no, it's not cool. And that's unfortunate, because I like Storm Reed a lot. And, like, if you saw Missing earlier this year, real good movie. She's a really good actress. This movie does not support that claim.
No, she's great in The Last of Us as well, when she appears in that.
Oh, very my God, good. Yeah, she is. Yeah.
Very impressed by it. She's just not great here, and it's frustrating because when they swung and gave us atmospheric and at times quite nasty horror, I thought, okay, and I'm not always a gore hand, I love horror, but sometimes you do need to push the boundaries, and they started doing that here, but then they went back to what they know, and that's where the film suffered for me.
Well, folks, that is our review of The Nun 2, Back in the Habit. Wait, that's different movie. but we are not recommending it. I think it seems fair to say, right?
I want to, because it shows glimpses, but I can't. No, I can't.
Yeah. Again, it's not to say that, you know, this is the worst movie by any means, but it just does not deliver on a lot of the things that it tries. That's it for our review. We will have a spoiler mini-sode dropping a couple days where we'll talk about some of the details that really irritated me, because that seems to be when I vent the most.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
But for now, let's move into Chuffed headlines. These are movie and pop culture news that caught our attention. Matt, what headline grabbed you this week?
This is one that has been kind of grinding my gears lately, or for the last few years. Not necessarily the headline, but what it represents. The headline, this is from Screen Rant, written by Nathan Graham Lowry. Headline reads, Disney releases The Little Mermaid Disney Plus viewership data, reveals it's one of 2023's biggest hits. It then goes on to say The Little Mermaid has swam onto Disney Plus and earned one of the streamer's best movie debuts despite its mixed box office performance over the summer. So what we're getting here is we're being told that The Little Mermaid, which is in the top 10 films of the year in terms of gross, it made just north of 500 million, I believe. We're being told now, actually, it's one of the film's biggest hits, year's biggest hits, because of its performance on Disney Plus. And the source is Disney. So Disney are telling us that their film that they released on their streaming is doing really well, guys. So go and watch it on their streaming service. And the reason I picked this one is firstly because I don't believe that for a second. And secondly, it comes in the wake of where we are now living in the WGA SAG-AFTRA strike territory. Guys, pay your workers fairly. We haven't got studios having to come out of new ways to market their films or to advertise what they've got. So recently, when a Star Wars Ahsoka came out, there were high headlines and articles going wild that Samba, the company in the United States that aggregates data, was saying, oh man, only 1.2 million people watch this show, which was highly misleading, because that was based on, I think we worked it out as only 3% of America is captured by Samba, and only 3% of that 3% was captured within this thing. So it was not in any way a blanket statement. But they were coming out saying that nobody's, essentially, man, this has had a lower viewership than Andor and stuff. What's happening? And blah, 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 blah. Then out of nowhere, Lucasfilm and Disney did the unprecedented thing of actually releasing an official statement on their website saying Ahsoka, I think it's actually the same figure, Ahsoka opened to 16 million or 14 million views over its first weekend. And their views are kind of like total views divided by minutes watched or something like that. So they took the unprecedented step for most streamers to come out and say, this is how many people watched our product, because we can see by a box office how well a film does, but historically, since Netflix and Amazon and all that have really set sail, we don't know how well these films do. We are only told by Netflix that the next Adam Sandler film was the biggest film of the year because it got 6 billion hits in the first couple of weeks, which that ain't happening in any dimension. But so streamers, streaming services have always been very coy about releasing the data, and I have no idea why. So when it comes to something like this, or even the Ahsoka announcement, I take it with a bit of a pinch of salt, even though the numbers look good. I think the Ahsoka one was very much a direct reaction, a direct response to the sites and the trades running the, this has only had a million views, nobody's watching it. That was very reactionary. And on Star Wars Sessions, a show I host over here, I actually said, I applaud Disney for actually coming out, if it's true, and saying, no, you guys are spreading fake news. We're going to put it straight. We are going to pull rank. We are going to use our power and muscle to tell you all that this show isn't, in fact, a failure. But this Little Mermaid one, though, this one seemed to come more out of nowhere. It was dropped yesterday. So it dropped at the beginning, pretty much the beginning of the week, beginning 11th of September. And it didn't really say anything other than what the headline says. Disney faced multiple high-profile struggles at the box office. Little Mermaid had a tumultuous run at the box office for many reasons. But now it's saying that, well, now it's on home video, it's getting new legs, excuse the film-related pun. Now, I don't doubt that The Little Mermaid is getting views on Disney Plus, whether it's people intrigue views or people rewatching it or people who couldn't afford to go to the cinema, because as we always say, it isn't cheap to take a family, and this is very much a family film. So I don't doubt that maybe it is getting high numbers.
It's definitely.
It just seems that, you know, just to come out and say, you know, 16 million is one of the year's biggest hits, that to me smacks a little bit of a studio panicking in the wake that we can't promote our film. We cannot get our cast to promote these. We have to find new ways to get people to watch. So let's say this. Now, listen, I'm sure these numbers are auditable, and maybe it is very, very true. But the discussion was more about, why aren't we seeing streaming services do this more? Why is there not a call or a need or even a mandate for streamers to release their figures? Home video, that used to be a huge revenue source for films and releases back in the 80s and 90s, home video and rental, and we'd be able to see how much money they made from those sources. We don't know how many they make from streaming. Maybe that's also because they want to cover up how much residuals they're not paying. But the question obviously here though, JP, is firstly, you see this, I'm a little bit more skeptical on the numbers itself, but the headline says 16 million people watch this and it's one of the biggest hits of the year. But the other question around it I wanted to hear your thoughts on is, should streaming companies really release their data more regularly so we have more transparency? Should that become a thing like we get box office numbers?
I mean, I think transparency is a good thing, especially because of the writer strike and the actor strike right now, that they don't really know the residual situation. Partly you just alluded to that. I think that's a reason why we should have access to those numbers. But I also wish though that we would reevaluate our definition of a success or a hit, right? Because people just like, let's say Jurassic World Dominion, right? I don't know how much money it made last year, but it made a decent amount of money. And yeah, that was last year, listeners, that movie doesn't exist, but I don't think anyone who saw it would argue. Okay. I'll be a less hyperbolic for a second. I think most people would argue that's not a good movie, but it made a lot of money. And studios seem to have this narrow mind of only looking at that. And then the point being that if you're only weighing it based on the numbers and not what people have now seen and are saying about it, because just because the amount of people who have suddenly seen Little Mermaid has increased because of availability, right, doesn't mean it's a good movie or a bad movie if no one is watching it, even if it's on streaming, because sometimes streaming services bury incredible films, right? Yeah. Like, we should be looking at it from all perspectives. The more people who see something, the more opinions we're going to get to hear, right? And so I want movies to make box office, and I want movies that are on streaming services to get views, because it increases the conversation about those films. But I wish studio execs would listen to the conversation about those films. And again, I wish audiences, general audiences, not necessarily people like us who obsess over and have studied over, but would be a little more like vocal about, maybe a little more deliberate about how good or bad something is. Like The Nun having a 74% on Rotten Tomatoes, I don't think really sets the tone for what that movie really is. Are there going to be people who really enjoy that movie? Yes. There are people who really enjoy eating a McDonald's hamburger, but there are people who've had hamburgers from all types of restaurants and all different types of places and know there's a difference of quality from a McDonald's, you know, made in 30 seconds cheeseburger and one that's been, you know, treated with a level of respect and love that you just won't get at a fast food establishment, regardless of the brand.
And you can enjoy both happily.
And you can enjoy both. And that's more what I'm saying. Like, it's okay to like The Nun, even if we didn't, for sure. The movies exist for a wide variety of audiences, but what I'm for is those audiences getting the opportunity to see it. And like you said, taking a family of five to the movie theater is $100 just to get tickets.
Yeah.
And then having to tell them to, sorry, we can't get popcorn because we just spent $100 on tickets, but then, you know, ending up needing to, okay, fine, we'll get popcorn because we're at a movie theater and that's what we do. It's not easy for everyone to do, especially right now. So,
and if the film's bad, you've just wasted $100 already.
Right. Or if
If you don't know what it's going to be like, you're taking a punt.
Yeah, and if there's 30 movies that come out this summer and you can only go once, you're going to have to be very selective. Where, especially if you know, well, we always have Disney Plus because Disney Plus has all of the shows my kid likes, or it has all the Marvel movies, or it has the Star Wars show, so I'm keeping that subscription. If I wait long enough, Little Mermaid will show up. And I think we should take that into consideration. A movie's success should not solely exist in box office. And we call a lot of films that have a life after box office cult films, like Scott Pilgrim versus the World, notoriously did bad in theaters, but has a huge following of fans now, you know, over 10 years later. But we've always had that, you know, like movies that don't get the distribution numbers or didn't have the mass audience appeal. Maybe just didn't have a theatrical run big enough. We know that. And yet these executives and these people, they act like we don't know that, right? Like that it's a mystery. Like, oh, people watch movies at home. Yes. Since you've made VHSs or Betamax, we've watched movies at home and we watch them in droves, you know? So yeah, streaming is going to have more numbers because a lot more people have access, but, and again, it's a lot less. $9 for 1,000 movies versus $9 a person to see one movie. A lot of people are going to opt to wait for streaming. So yeah, reveal the numbers so that we can see that a movie does, you know. And again, though, I will point out, just because a bunch of people watch it doesn't make it good.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not commentary necessarily on The Little Mermaid, and I wouldn't want to put words in your mouth either. But and I hope people do go to watch Little Mermaid for a variety of reasons and give it, whether I thought it was pretty middling. I thought Halle Bailey was fun in it, but
yep,
the film itself was fine. But yeah, like you say, what do you do, you pay $100 just to get in and then potentially another 50 on concessions, or maybe 30 or 40 on concessions on a film which it may or may not work, it might not, in, you know, all your kids might not enjoy it, or do you wait 2 months, watch it on Disney Plus for the cost of your subscription, and then whoever doesn't like it can dip out. It's an easy decision to make, really. It really, really is an easy decision to make. You choose the latter, and that's one of the problems with streaming. It's convenient, but same time. But yeah, I'm with you, JB. Release the numbers. Let's make that a competitive thing now. Let's look at box office numbers and streaming figures, and make it more of a conversation. But yeah, I was just interested in your thoughts on that. I haven't seen what you've gone for, JB, and I still haven't seen, so I'm looking forward to what you think this week.
So I was a slacker, listeners, and I forgot to read an article ahead of time. But earlier today, I had an email from A24, and not like to me, but it was just like, you know, I'm on their mailing list. They weren't like, hey, Burke. But Talk to Me is available now on digital, but more importantly, it is getting a Blu-ray release, which I'm all for physical media. So I was excited to see this. It's going to get a 4K Blu-ray digital combo on October 3rd. So it's getting a full-on release. I know a lot of people, like we were just saying with theaters, not everyone made it to the theater to see Talk to Me, and I really liked it a lot. A lot of people really liked it a lot. Not everybody, but it's a little more of a traditional horror film, especially considering that it's got the A24 label. I would not call it elevated horror, but I would call it atmospheric as anything, and some really good performances. I saw it twice, and I definitely think I'm going to add this to my collection. So I was excited to see it's getting a Blu-ray release. There's some really cool merch because you can actually get the hand There's a lamp, I think. And I'm like, man, I don't know if I've ever wanted anything from a horror movie as badly as I want that stupid hand. But I'm very hyped. The freaking cover for it's really cool too. Actually, there's two different covers in the article that is linked in the show notes. Matt, are you thinking of picking up Talk to Me?
I didn't even need you to talk to me to tell me that. Yeah, damn right I am. I thought Talk to Me was great. I think, without checking, and for the benefit of time, I'll just guess, but I'm pretty sure it is still my number one horror film of the year. I could be mistaken there, but it's certain, if it's not number one, it's in the top three of the year. I too got that email. It's coming to Blu-ray on October the 3rd, and I looked at the official Talk to Me party hand, as it's been called, and I think it's $110. I'm not sure I can part of £100 for it, but it would certainly be a talking point at the parties I don't have. So I'd love to maybe around, touch the hand, you know, maybe pretend, like, set off some smoke bombs and think something's going on. But I love that A24 does this. I love A24. Firstly, they've agreed to the SAG after WDA demands. Or demands or requests, should we call them. And they're getting on because they're a studio who just wants to make films. And I love that they do this. They did it with Everything Everywhere All at Once when they also released the Hot Dog Fingers. You can get the gloves.
Yeah.
The Hot Dog. They went very quickly, so they released another batch. And now with Talk To Me, they're releasing The Hand. I love that they're doing this and almost making it these kind of collectibles, these limited edition type things, which you can only get for a certain period. But I like that they're almost like eventizing their releases. It's not just, you know, here's our new film on Blu-ray, buy it, let's move on to the next one. They're making something from it. And of course, we're getting Talk To Me, which I guess will be Talk To Me, I don't know, the sequel. But yeah, man, I will absolutely be picking this up. Man, October 30th, a few weeks' time. I remember when we had to wait months and months, like half a year, if not longer, for the physical release. And now it's just around the corner.
I have a friend that lives in Germany now, and they only had Talk To Me playing with German dub, but no English subtitles. And so she's been like losing her mind because she really, really wants to see it. And I was just like, I'm hoping that the Blu-ray is going to, you know, be out there at the same date, because she's been waiting to see it. And I don't know if I'm gonna have to like figure out a way to ship it to her or something so she can watch it with the English, the actual,
after all that.
Yeah. But she's a big fan of horror and is really, really wanting to see this. And I feel bad. It's gotta be torture. Like, it's like literally playing right there. I could walk to it, but I won't understand any of the words. I gave her the option. I was like, I know it's against the law to FaceTime during a movie, but would you like me to like just kind of walk you through what happened? I've seen it twice. Like, I probably know enough. I can't give you a word for word dialogue, but I can tell you, oh yeah, she's talking about her mom right here. Like, you know,
what
didn't
man
take me up on it. Yeah. But yeah. So listeners, if you are excited like we are, get ready to pick up your copy of Talk To Me on October 3rd. You know, we're not paid to say that. I want that to be clear. This was an article, and I was like, cool. I'm hyped for this movie. I know a lot of people are aware of it, but it's still an indie film in my eyes. So I like to keep spreading awareness about it. If you like horror and you didn't see it, get ready. It's going to be available. And again, you can rent it right now. In fact, it's on digital. So, I should tell her that instead. But, yeah, that's our headlines for the week. Let's focus in on what we've been consuming. Matt, I need to know, sir, what movies, TV, video games, music, podcasts have you been consuming since the last time we recorded? Talk To Me, bud.
Here we go. Not many, JP, actually. And there is reason for that. Partly because I had my daughter for an extra day this week. So that was the day where I'd usually go to, that was a Friday, when I'd usually go to the cinema to either watch this week's BAMP film or something else if I know I'm going to watch it later on. But so I didn't do that for good reason. I'll mention that later on. But instead, I have been reading this week, JB. You know me, I love to read Star Wars books or listen to the audiobooks. And this week I've been reading one called From a Certain Point of View, Return of the Jedi. And this is, as that film was the final part of the original trilogy of films, this is the final part of an anthology trilogy of books, of which I very much enjoyed. Basically, every film in the OT, so Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and Jedi, have had an edition of this anthology released where it's celebrating the 40th anniversary of the release of the film. So in each book, there are 40 short stories by 40 different authors told from the point of view of secondary characters, background characters, sometimes new characters, but all within the context of the film. So for example, the first one, A New Hope, would have, you know, one of the aliens in the cantina would be doing their bit, and you find out about them and where they've come and what they're doing. But at the same time, across the cantina, Greedo has just been shot by Han Solo and kind of the reaction to that. And, or there'll be one of the pilots in the trench run at the end. Like, what's their story? What was the trench run like from their perspective, especially because most of them died? And stuff like that. Like, really, really, really kind of, it's all canon. It all counts to the main line, but we're not telling Luke Skywalker's or Han or Leia's story. It's about the other characters from a certain point of view. So what I think is a really, really cool initiative. And every sale of every book goes towards a charity in the United States, which gives books and stationeries to underprivileged children, which is obviously a fantastic drive and initiative, and the books have done very well. So the first one was 2017 for 1977, 40 years. Second one was 2020 for the 40th of Empire. Now, after 6 years, we have the final one. So I've basically been reading 40 short stories over the last few days, mixed in with some audiobook listening as well. And I'm not going to give a review of the book per se, that will come out on the Sessions website, but I really liked the very first one of A New Hope. The Empire one I thought was really strong, and this one I liked, didn't love it. It was probably the weakest of the three, despite having some of the best stories in it, like Anakin when he dies at the end of Jedi, spoiler, and he becomes one with the Force. What was that like when he finally reunites with Obi-Wan? That kind of stuff, very, very cool. But there's stories that if you don't know, then it doesn't matter. And that's how the canon should work for me, that they should supplement the main live action stuff in a way that if you read these books, it can add flavor to what you see on screen. But if you don't, you're not missing anything. That's how they should work. And I think these books do a great job. It was a very satisfying ending that it wasn't the kind of like the blockbuster I thought it was going to be. So that's what I've basically been reading that for a long time, between work, hanging out with my kid, been reading that. So I've only watched one film this week, JB, but goddamn was it a doozy. We said off air about sometimes when you're running out of time and you haven't got time, but you want to watch something. I don't want to commit to a series because it takes too long, even though there's some I really want to watch, like The Bear. So I sat you down. Should. I know, I really want to. And I watched Aliens, which actually, weird enough, I know is going to kind of tie into something you mentioned you're going to talk about, but Aliens, obviously the sequel, the 86 film. Who doesn't love Aliens? I mean, come on. So I was like, I want to watch that. Why didn't you put her in charge, man? Game over, man. I can't do the voice, but the hero is called Hudson. Why wouldn't you want to watch it alongside Ripley? Nothing to say about Aliens other than it's fantastic. We all know that. And I was like, you know what? I want to watch something where I know what happens. I can cheer. I can holler at the big lines, get away from her, you so-and-so, Aliens. And then I listened to one podcast this week, and it's one I've never heard before. I'd heard of it. I think I follow them on X, I think. It's called All the Right Movies. It's a British film podcast hosted by four guys from up north. So they've all got funny accents. I'm sure the northerners won't mind me saying that. But it came up on my Spotify, almost like a recommended for you, because they were talking about Ghostbusters from 1984. And I was like, oh, it's 2 hours long. I've never heard of these guys other than following them, but I've never heard them. So it could be awful for all I know. But I very much enjoyed it. There's four guys talking about how much they loved Ghostbusters. They were, you know, critical at times of some of the effects and all that, but how much they loved Ghostbusters and why, and the characters. And they apparently pride themselves on every fact that they mention, or every bit of trivia has been backed up by three veritable sources, whether that's somebody in the film or the cast or the crew, or like an actual legitimate source. There's no like BS thrown. And I was like, you know what, I dig that. It could be, I dig the research and the confidence in knowing that what I'm being told here about the behind the scenes is, you know, it is true. I quite enjoyed that, and it made me want to go back and watch Ghostbusters again. But I've decided that for the time being, I'm going to save it. I'm going to watch it towards Halloween with my kid. She's 7. She loves the idea of Ghostbusters. She's met the Ghostbusters, you know, the Ghostbusters. She's even got her own Ghostbusters name badge, the thing you iron on. She's got that there. So she likes the idea of Ghostbusters, and I know she's watched a few of the YouTube things, but I haven't actually shown her the film yet, because I was like, I wonder if it's going to be too scary for her. But I thought, you know what? She's ready. Let's watch it at Halloween. Let's have some fun, because it is a fun film. It's got some great horror moments. Again, not going to review Ghostbusters. When they decide to lean into horror, I remember as a kid, I was a bit freaked out by some of the terror dog stuff, but got to learn. You got to give them a backbone somehow, I guess. So I'm going to save Ghostbusters for closer to Halloween. I'm going to watch it with my kid, and hopefully she digs it as much as I did as a kid and still do now. But yeah, so not really very much, JB. I've just been busy with work and just doing stuff to not be able to watch films. And I've also been rearranging my geeky area here in the room I'm in at the minute, putting my Blu-rays into a folder. Not quite as organised as you, though I'd let you explain that whenever you want to. But so I've actually been I've just been renovating and chilling out and being busy with my kid and reading. So I wanted to watch more movies, but Alas, not as many as I wanted to. What I will say, sorry, before I move over to you, is I did text you this because I want to throw this out there. When I watched The Nun 2, mm-hmm. and all by myself, there was, cause this is a weird thing. When we were watching the trailers, there were people in there, but then they buggered off. They left.
Oh.
When the trailers had finished. So I don't know if they're waiting to see certain trailers. Cause I remember texting you this, and I'm aware that at the beginning of the show, I said I was the only one, cause I was, but at the beginning there was a few people there. They're talking away, yeah. Fine, whatever. The Saw X trailer comes on. Yeah, they're watching it. People are talking away. And even I was watching like, this looks awful, but it might be good. And then the Exorcist Believer trailer came on. You see the shot of the room and that. And when people saw, when Ellen Burstyn came on and you got that pan shot, where we then see the little girl on the bed eating the Bible pages for some reason. They all shut up and they just watched and they were in. When they realised what this was, they were in. And they didn't say anything during it. They were just in. And I remember texting JP. I was like, you know, that's pretty cool, actually, because I have my thoughts on whether the film's going to be any good and so does the internet. But sitting in a theatre with people who were there, who I thought were there to watch The Nun too, I think they must have just snuck in. But when this trailer came, when they stopped, they watched it, there was no laughing, giggling or jeering. It was just Ian. I was like, you know what? That's very cool. It made my horror loving heart quite happy. And then a couple of minutes, not long before the film started, when we were getting to like the Pepsi Max adverts, they just left. See you later. A whole row of people who obviously just gone to watch another film, thought they'd come and sit down and watch this one and didn't. But yeah, I just thought it was very cool that trailer came on and it's the second trailer that seemed to grip people enough that they shut up and watched it. Hopefully it's a good sign. But other than that groundbreaking bit of news, JB, it's been a pretty weak, quite a week on the media consumption, but I'm sure you're going to have enough to tide us over.
Yeah. I'm going to not talk quite as long with the movies cause I have a lot, but Blank Check started their new director series. We just finished listeners of the show, Blankies, as we call ourselves. Just finished with the Park Chan-wook series, and now we're jumping right in to David Fincher. And I mentioned this last week because this is the first time in a while where I don't have any gaps to watch. I've seen all of his movies, but I might rewatch The Game for next week because I haven't seen The Game since like high school. But Alien 3, which I also probably could revisit. I've only seen it once, I think, but I liked Alien 3.
I appreciate it more and more when I watch it.
Yeah, like I prefer Alien to Aliens. Like, I like Aliens. Don't get me wrong. Don't come at me.
That's the debate, isn't it? Who prefers what? But they're both great.
I like the tone of the first one a lot more. I prefer the horror elements to the action elements of the second film. Not that, again, I think the second film's great. The third film pulls back a little bit, and it's definitely doing different stuff than the first film, but it's more in...
More like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's more in that kind of vibe. And there's some iconic stuff in the third film. I hate Resurrection, though. Like, I think that movie is preposterously stupid.
It's awful.
Yeah, but so on the Patreon, though, instead of doing commentary, which is usually what they do, they did a special episode for AVP and AVP Requiem because they've covered all of the Alien films already on the Patreon. They did commentary on them a while back because they did James Cameron a while back on the main feed. So we already had covered Aliens. So like, they're like, well, let's do AVP and AVP Requiem, just like a review episode, so that they've knocked out every movie that has an alien in it. Cause they did, I think, Prometheus and Covenant in that Alien series, but they skipped AVP cause they're not canonical to either. I don't think they're canonical.
No,
yeah. So they're just like these spinoffs. It was a funny episode because Ben has never seen either. Ben is the producer, but also these are more his vibe. He's not like, he's become a bigger movie person over the years, but he's definitely more of like a casual movie fan who is the producer of the podcast with two film nerds, essentially one legitimate film critic and one who's become a legitimate film critic. And so it was a really, really funny episode hearing them kind of explaining these movies and remembering how bad they actually are.
As bad. It's got some cool ideas.
The first one fails to me with the same thing that happens with the Transformers films. It's like, we're here to see the Transformers. Yes. I was there to see aliens fighting predators.
Yep.
Or the other way around. I was here to see predators fighting aliens. I didn't need the human aspect of that film at all. That was, I haven't seen it since it came out. Like, I saw it in, at a, the first time I ever went to an Alamo Draft House, was to see AVP. And I was so frustrated because I'm like, I just want to see the predator kill the aliens and or aliens kill the predator. I don't.
It's literally the title of the film. They go to some like ruins, I think like Antarctica or something. And they give background lore, which is cool, but.
And just, honestly, those two characters are just so cool. That's why I'm there. Like I'm still, it's still better than it not. But you know, it's rough. My film selection, I'm going to bounce around a little bit. I went, my daughter and I went to see Bottoms. We had to drive about 40 minutes to see it, but I was super stoked that our, one theater got it. We went early, like a 5 o'clock showing, and it was weird because like it was a Friday night, 5 o'clock showing, but like the theater was completely dead at 5 o'clock. When we left the movie, a lot more people were in the out there. It's a big multiplex, so I don't know if any of them were actually going to see Bottoms. There was one other person with us in our screening for it, and about 30 minutes in, something went wrong with the sound, where at first I thought it was a director's choice that I couldn't understand, because but it sounded like, I thought maybe like they were trying to express like that they were in their own head too much and they weren't really hearing like the world around them, like everything felt echoey. And then it kept going. I was like, uh-oh, I don't think this is a choice. I think something has gone wrong with the sound. So like I ran out to the manager and they went in, and it took about 30 more minutes before it finally fixed. So for about 30 minutes of the movie, the middle of the film, it sounded like they were talking into cans, which wasn't terrible, but it definitely was like, we should be hearing a lot clearer the dialogue. But regardless, it didn't affect our opinion of the film. We both really enjoyed it. Super funny. It was more absurdist than I was expecting when I went into it. I didn't realize how over the top the setup and the world was going to be, but not in a bad way. I just was expecting a more traditional, like American Pie type teen sex comedy, and it's a little more satirical than I was anticipating, which is a good thing. I think it's has a lot more to say than maybe American Pie ever did. I liked it enough, and also Rachel Senoit, is that how you say her name?
Rich Senos. I know who you mean. Yeah,
she's in Bodies as well. I had not seen the director's or her previous collaboration, Shiva Baby, and that's on HBO. Or I'm sorry, it's on Max, the one you watch for HBO. And so I caught that because it's only like 90 minutes too. No, I'm sorry, Matt, it's less than that. I think it's 60 minutes.
My kind of film.
And so I caught that. On HBO, and I also really liked it. Someone on Letterboxd called it Uncut Gems for like hot girls. and yes, it's so anxiety inducing. Her performance is phenomenal. It's very much her performance too, because it is like the camera's almost exclusively with her throughout the film. Really tight, really tense, super still funny though, still funny, but much more serious than Bottoms. But I think both movies are really good. The filmmaker, I wish I could remember her name, but it's not coming to me. Very promising career. She's showing that she has a lot of talent with the camera and also something to say. She has a point to get across.
Nice.
Now, I have, the other night I was just scrolling through, I think, Hulu, looking for something easy to throw on in the background. And I have been meaning to watch Real Steel for a long time. When it first came out, I wrote it off as nonsense. I was just like, whatever, lame. And then I heard people like, no, it's actually pretty good. And I have some major boxing movie gaps. Like, I still haven't watched Southpaw, which I love Jake Gyllenhaal, so I don't know what I'm waiting on. I should probably make an effort to watch that. But I tend to like boxing movies. The simple, it's such an easy conflict to write to. You know, it's person versus person. Boom, what do you got? And I was kind of impressed with Real Steel. Not only is Jackman great, the kid's actually really good in it. Yeah. I think Evangeline Lilly, it's one of her better, like she's very much in the background, but I really liked her performance in it. Not that I don't like, I'm a big Lost fan. So I liked her a lot in Lost. And I like her in the Wasp role, but I thought just here, I wish her character would have got some more time, but There's one thing that I really like about Real Steel that shocked me is early in the film, we see Jackman make a deal with the, I guess the uncle of the kid where like you pay me, I'll take him for the summer kind of thing. And you're like,
yeah, yeah.
I'm like, this is going to be the predictable movie where he'll start to get along, but the kid will find out that he like took money to be with him, and then he'll get mad and they'll have a fight. And in the movie immediately is like, no, the kid knows from the get go that he took money to be with him. And you don't have to worry about that being the reason they don't get along later in the film. I was like, oh, yep, well, how great enough. Is that? I actually really appreciate that. Like, yeah, it seems so trite and like tropish. And then they're like, no, it's not that. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. I had a blast with the movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. The visuals are strong. What is it?
Fighting robots. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but in a way that has like character and like actual like stakes at times.
Yeah. I hate the poster for this film. I'll say that. Like, it looks cheap as hell, but which is what would actually have put me off watching it. But then when you look at who's in it and what it's about, there is an intrigue there. And I didn't mind Real Steel. You know me, I love a boxing film specifically. And I thought Real Steel was pretty good. It's fine.
Yeah. I think it's it's a popcorn movie for sure. Like, I'm not sitting here like it. This is change my view on cinema, but no, I think it's something that I initially wrote off, and I'm glad I finally went to it. I think it's much better than I gave credit to initially. Again, with no unfair, I had no reason to not give it a chance, but I definitely didn't. So I'm glad that I did. I have a review up of My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3. Didn't need to happen. End of story. It's unnecessary. Yeah, it's very, very choppy in its storytelling. Yet, it's still, there's something charming about it. But yeah, overall, I thought not great. Then, Matt, in preparation for next month, I've seen every Saw film but 6 and 7.
Well, they're the best ones, John.
So I own the original 7. Like, not the movie. I also own the original movie 7, but I mean, I own the original 7 Saw films. I don't think I own Jigsaw or Spiral unless Regal gave them to me for free. I don't remember if I got those as digital copies. I feel like I did. I feel like those were the Liongate specials at some point. But David Sims from Blank Check was talking about the Saw. In fact, at the beginning of the AVP episode, bonus episode, it sounds like it's a Saw episode because he's talking about watching all the movies because he'd never seen any of them except for the first one. Oh, that's the other James Wan movie I like. I like Saw.
Saw, man. That's the one that broke him out as well.
Yeah. And I was like, Saw blew me away when I saw it in the theater in 2004. Like, I was just like, what? This is incredible.
Touch point in culture. Yeah, here.
It didn't age well. Like, I don't think it's nearly as intelligent as I thought it was in 2004. But at the time, it was really impressive. I was really into the franchise for the first, like, four. I think five. I can't remember which one has the pigs in it. But that one's where I started to, like, ooh, this is too much for me. I don't think I can handle this anymore. And I didn't bother with 6, and I didn't bother with 7. I also, I don't think the person they put in the lead in 3, I think, is when he shows up. I think he's boring as hell, and he doesn't get better. So 6 and 7, I watched last night. I got to say, I think they're bad, but I enjoyed watching both of them so much. So I was only planning on watching 6 last night, and they're only 90 minutes long each. And I finished, and it was just 9 o'clock. I'm like, I'm going to go ahead and watch the other one. I just want to knock them out. I want to, like, let's be done with this. So I threw it immediately on. I went right from 6 into 7. 7 is extra bad, and I'm watching the beginning because it opens with a scene that never is explained, which is I think the only time in the franchise where we see a game that has no explanation or tie into the main plot of the movie at all. It's just like, it's the most public game too, because they're like on a glass display where like there's a literal crowd. It is the most, it's in this for the 3D movie scene that it could have been. And
I really don't remember this one at all.
Dude, so it's called Saw the Final Chapter now, but it was originally Saw 3D, but they stopped calling it that because it's not in 3D unless you have a 3D TV. So it's just the final chapter. But the blood in the opening sequence is so pink that while watching it, I'm like, wait, is this like, are people pretending? I thought maybe like they were like a theater troupe pretending to be like it's a Saw game, but then it's like not, and it's not that. It's pink. Because when you wore the real D glasses, it darkens the screen. So like with the glasses on, it would look like blood apparently. But when you don't have the 3D and they apparently could not color correct it well enough for the DVD release, it's freaking pink. Like it is the fakest looking blood. I mean, there are Vincent Price movies from the 60s that have better looking fake blood. Yeah, terrible looking, but, and also the movie in general, I think looks bad. Like there's this weird stylistic choice where it's supposed to be like a hazy dream sequence, but it just looks terrible. And I don't know if that was also for 3D, or what, but there is a really crazy twist at the end of Seven that I was like, okay. I'm kind of glad I finished the franchise because I didn't know about this part of it. Then I'm actually more disappointed with Jigsaw and Spiral though, because they don't do anything with the way Saw 7
especially
ends.
Spiral, yeah.
But yeah, Spiral really is trash. I'm hoping Saw X has something, man. But there's a scene in 7 where, because, you know, John Kramer is getting older, but he's only in flashbacks after the third movie. Mm. So he's supposed to be younger Kramer, but he's not younger Kramer because he's getting older. And there's a part where he's wearing a hoodie and a backwards baseball cap.
Yes.
And I'm like, is he trying to be like, look, yep, I'm a teenager? Like, it reminds me of Steve Buscemi's in a movie or a show where he's like, hey, cool cats, and he's trying to be like a high school kid. I can't think of what movie it was, like a sketch comedy or something.
Hello, fellow kids.
Yeah, and it's like, that's what the vibe was. I'm like, oh, what did they do?
I've seen that online. I can't claim it's one, but on the internet, you know, the internet never fails. They were like, all these studios nowadays spending tens of millions on deep faking and de-aging, yeah, and in or whatever. They just had Tobin Bell stick his cap on backwards and like, yeah, that would, yeah, do. Yeah, that's literally it.
Oh, it's so funny. Yeah. But yeah, and
still awful though.
Yeah, it's bad, but funny at the same time. That's what I've been watching. I haven't been playing as much games. I did start Jedi Survivor, but I haven't played it as much as I should. It just feels like so much. There's so many things on that game. But I've been playing Marvel Snap, and I returned to Disney Dreamlight Valley a little bit because sometimes you just got to chill with the easy games where it's just like,
oh yeah,
you know, farming and such. But that's what I've been consuming.
No, it's the usual smorgasbord of fun.
Yep, usual mix. Again, some fun stuff out there. Real Steel, fun movie.
Check it out.
Well, before we leave, folks, we got to check in with each other because it takes a lot of work to stay this bloody awesome. And Matt, I just need to know that you're keeping those levels in check. So what have you been doing to stay bloody awesome?
Well, it's been out of this world, JB. Literally, because at the end of the week, when I picked my kid up, I did so specifically on the Friday so we could go to the planetarium. There, where I live, is the only planetarium in a public school or state school, I guess, in the country. And it's my old school as well, which is pretty cool. And they've got this big old planetarium, big old dome you sit in. And they've got these fabulous HD domes ceiling, which has projected on the night sky. Everyone out there who knows what a planetarium is knows what happens. But if you don't, they project the night sky on from any time, pretty much any time. Obviously, there is a limit. But so, for example, we'd sit there, we got in there, and they showed us what the sky looked like at that minute. It's very cloudy that day, so we couldn't see it. But it is what it looked like, and this is where the constellations and the planets are. But I took my kid there because they were doing, I think they called it like a, I don't know what they called it, like a stellar safari or something like that, Planet Explorer, something even simpler. Basically, they just took us to every planet. It was aimed for kids, like 5 and upwards. So they'd take you to the planets and they'd show you any pictures that NASA, whoever had got of the planets. So what was it like to be on or to be near Venus, for example? And we get some facts about Venus, and you know, they didn't get the kids to ask questions. And on Mars, because we've actually been to Mars as a civilization, we've actually been there, we've touched the rovers down, and we can see it. They kind of turn the room, they turn the planetarium dome the same color as it would be on Mars. So you felt like you're on that planet for the minute, and we've got the huge cliffs faces of Mars next to you. It's very cool and informative. And it went all the way down to Neptune. And they did mention things like Pluto and some of the dwarf planets, as they're called. And there's one really cool fact. It's one of the moons of, I don't know where it was, maybe Jupiter or somewhere like, or maybe even Neptune, where they're like, do you know what? This actual planet is an ocean planet, like Kamino in Star Wars. I'll get to that in a minute. But it is encased in ice. So they're like, well, we know that there are fissures coming out of it, so there's potentially huge oceans underneath this planet, which potentially means if there's water, there could be some kind of life and things like that. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. I'm learning like, all this really cool stuff. It was mainly for my kid, but I was like, I'm enjoying this. I'm digging this. I like space. I am constantly amazed by the wonder of what the space and the solar system is. I think you can't comprehend it, but I love the idea of trying. And of course, you know, Uranus came up and I was like, hee, giggle. But the kids are asking questions. And I thought, well, you know, I said, how far away is Coruscant? Star Wars. Sorry, where's that? Oh no, it's the worst thing that could have happened. I'm not going to explain to these people. So I was like, oh no, it's a small planet I'd heard of somewhere. And she's like, please move on. But I was really hoping that, you know, she would have got it and played along, but this dad looked a bit daft for a few seconds, but as my kid will tell you, that is absolutely nothing new. But you know, I just went to a planetarium recently, checked out hopped to all the planets, got some cool facts, and it's a nice way to spend an hour on a Friday evening, and it supported a local business and my old school as well, so win right there. So JB, did you take a trip off world, or were you very much feet on the ground?
Feet on the ground, and you know, that's sometimes necessary, but just balancing the old budget. You know, I've mentioned changing careers, not careers so much as locations, I guess. Still teaching, just teaching what my actual major was in for my master's degree, which is unheard of. But that comes with, you know, some refinancing and attempting to get some debt under control. And, so I made a major change to my car insurance. That was a huge help with the budget. So being an adult, having to like do a lot of research, because I haven't switched my insurance in a long time. So I like, can I just cancel before the thing? Do I have to wait till the end? When do I have to, you know, like, is it like Indiana Jones, like taking the idol off and having to like put the sand on immediately so that the boulder doesn't trigger? Like, that's what it feels like when you're switching. It's like, you got to have insurance, but you can't cancel it because then they'll charge you. And it's like, and I figured it out and I was like, okay, had to call someone. They canceled. I immediately got the other insurance and instantly saved a bunch of money. And then the best part, Matt, was finding out that I was ahead a month somehow. I don't know how. At some point they must've charged me twice or something, but I got a refund, which I was like, I was apprehensive. I'm like, she said that maybe she was looking at the wrong thing, or maybe it was already like assuming that I would have paid, because I like my insurance came out the 12th of every month. So I was like, until I get the refund, I'm gonna assume that was a mistake on her part. It was not. I got my refund today. I was like, oh my God, that's an extra $300 that I was not expecting to have. And so all little things like that just made a lot of stress of job transitioning feel a little less stressful. And I need that, because, you know, switching a job, the new job is great, but it's still like, it was a major life change. It's a farther drive, which is, you know, I'm used to my 10 minute commute that I've been doing for 13 years is now suddenly a 35 to 40 minute commute with a lot more traffic. You know, those little changes are stressful enough. And again, just that familiarity with my old job, I've been there for so long. Definitely felt like another home almost. And so suddenly changing and being in a new place and trying to find my spot, I needed to get my budget under control, so I at least had that stress off. And right now, feeling a little better about it. So I'm grateful for I adulted, and I adulted okay. I didn't fall, so like, yeah, I must have done
it. I'm proud of you, JP. You, adulting stinks most of the time, but they say money doesn't make the world go round, which may be true, but an unexpected refund definitely puts a smile on our faces. So more of those, please.
Well, I have some bad news though, man.
Oh no.
Because next week we're going to be talking about a haunting in Venice. And if I recall correctly, we were not the biggest fans of Midnight on the Orient Express, or more importantly, we were not a big fan of Death on the Nile.
Didn't mind the first one. Didn't like the second one.
Yeah, that's about how. Like, the first one disappointed me because I was so like hyped for the idea of it, because I think that was post Knives Out, and I love Knives Out, so I was like, all right, another mystery.
I think it was a few months before.
Well,
and then Knives Out came out a month or so later, and was like, ah, that's how you do it.
Yeah, what I couldn't remember the order of events, but I was hyped for both of those films because I like the idea of these mystery films.
Yes.
Just Ryan Johnson is doing a better job with it than Kenneth Branagh. But well, we're gonna have a Haunting in Venice with a star-studded cast. It's going to be in theaters everywhere this weekend, and we will be watching it to review it next week. Of course, we'll have our spoiler mini-sode for The Nun 2, probably short and sweet because this episode went a little long. But in the meantime, we'd love to hear your thoughts on The Nun 2 or my opinion of James Wan's movies. Maybe don't be too cruel to me. I'm sorry. You can like them. They don't click for me. But you can hit us up on social media. On Instagram, we're at Bloody Awesome Movie Pod, and same as Threads. And Matt, where can they find us on X and or Twitter?
X/Twitter, BAMP underscore podcast, BAMP underscore podcast.
And we're still on the old Facebook, search Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast, and you can follow us there. Remember, we are a Rotten Tomato approved podcast, so you can see our ratings on the Tomatometer and see, you know, I think we're going rotten on The Nun 2, unfortunately.
We will be.
Individually, you can follow me at BurkeReviews.com and at BurkeReviews on all these social media platforms. Matt, where can they find you?
WhatIWatchTonight.co.uk and search What I Watch Tonight across all of the socials, including Letterboxd.
And if you like what we're doing here at the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast, we ask that you take a moment and give us that 5-star rating on whatever podcast catcher you use to listen. With that, we encourage you to keep watching movies.
And stay bloody awesome.
Blood, 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 bloody. 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 Blood, blood, bloody.
Awesome!